Hello, and welcome back to another episode of True Crime Boulevard. I'm your host, Brie, and this week on the Boulevard, we're going to be talking about the Ken and Barbie killers, Paul Bernardo and Carla Homolka. So get ready. We're going to go head over to Canada. So in this episode, we're going to be talking about sexual assaults, rape, murder. So this episode is going to be pretty graphic. This episode is also going to probably be a little explicit, so if you're not a big fan of my sailor mouth, then I probably tell you not to listen this week. So yeah, like I said every week, please take care of yourself and your mental health. If this episode is too much for you, if there's anything in this episode that you feel is going to be too much for you, please take care of yourself, and you know, you can go listen to a past episode, and I'm sure you'll be able to join us in a future episode. So with all of that said, we're going to go ahead and hop into this because this is a pretty freaking messed up case. This is a case that took me a while to really like research and type up just because there is a lot going on in this case. And being a survivor of sexual assault, sometimes these cases can be really hard for me. So I took my time in getting the information together. I'm not going to go into a lot of details just because, again, this is a pretty graphic case. But there are movies, documentaries, podcasts, all kinds of different things out there that you can go and watch and get more information from. I listen to a bunch of different podcasts. As you guys know, I love me a good Morbid or My Favorite Murder. The Murder Squad, they also did an episode of this. Crime Junkies also did an episode. There's a lot of people who've done podcast episodes on this. I've listened to a lot of those. Discovery Plus also has a Ken and Barbie documentary out there that's pretty good, so if you would like to go watch that, you can. And I'm gonna say this now, I am doing this episode strictly so that I can talk about Carla Homolka, because I cannot stand that woman and the fact that she is free after you find out this case, if you don't already know, probably rattles your head as much as it rattles mine. So we're gonna go ahead and hop into this. So, Paul Kenneth Bernardo was born August 27th, 1964 in Scarborough, Ontario, Canada. I'm going to let y'all know now that I'm going to butcher some of these territories in Canada. I listened to them. I tried to learn them. I still suck. I'm sorry. So, yeah. But all that to say, Paul Bernardo had a pretty messed up life kind of to begin with. His dad was Kenneth Bernardo. He was an abusive piece of shit. He was sexually assaulting his daughter, i.e. Paul's sister, and then later he was caught sexually assaulting another little girl, and he was charged with child molestation in 1978. So his early life was pretty rough. His dad was like just like really abusive in general to like his mom, his sister, him. Like, he was an abusive piece of shit. So that all caused Paul's mother to go into a very deep depression, especially after he was arrested and sent to jail for, you know, child molestation. And she completely withdrew from the family. So it was just kind of Paul and his sister doing their thing. But as he got older, he learned from his mother that he was the product of an extramarital affair, and this pissed him off. And when I say pissed him off, like, he started becoming verbally abusive to his mother because he was disgusted with her. He was so angry at her for having an affair with somebody else and him, you know, being a product of that affair. I don't understand why he was mad. Like, that doesn't make any sense to me. His father was sexually assaulting children and abusing his mother and his sister, and you're mad because he's not your dad? Bro, I would be so fucking happy if that was the case. Like, he's not my daddy? Great. Thank you. But no, he was very upset. So after he learns this, he goes off to college in 1980. And then in 1982, he starts working at Amway, which is an MLM. You know, the whole culture there is sales. They're trying to get people to buy stuff, buy into these companies or whatever. And he started reading a lot of books by motivational, like, get rich quick salesmen and all this stuff. Him and his friends were reading these books. and learning all of these sales pitches and all this stuff. And they would go out to bars and clubs and see if they could use these lines to pick up girls. And they were successful at it. Like, they would get girls in the clubs, like, that girls would come to hang out with them or whatever. And they would, you know, get their little night after. But in the clubs, doing this stuff is where Paul would meet his future wife, or as I like to call her, the seed of Satan, Carla Homolka, in 1987. So they meet, you know, they have a whirlwind of a romance. But before even all that happens, Paul had already started making a name for himself. So this is going to be my first trigger warning. He started stalking and attacking women at bus stops late at night. Like, he would stalk them for a while and kind of learn their routine, and he would attack them. So I'm going to tell you about his victims, that he did this with when he was called the Scarborough Rapist. This was just him by himself, not with Carla. And I'm not going to say the victims' names. So the victims that were assaulted in, like, during the Scarborough Rapist time, I'm not going to say a lot of their names, because a lot of them haven't actually, like, come out and said who they were. We just know because of Paul, and, like, their names are out there, but not because they put themselves out there, because other people did that. And so I'm going to respect their privacy and their right to not have their information out there. So I'm not going to say their names. But I will tell you, kind of like his timeline leading up to the shit that really gets kind of crazy. So the first assault that we know of was May 4th, 1987. He raped a 21-year-old Scarborough woman in front of her parents' house after he followed her home. And then May 14th, 1987, he raped a 19-year-old woman in the backyard of her parents' house. July 17th, 1987, he attempted to rape a young woman, but she fought back, and because she fought back, he ran off. September 29th, 1987, he attempted to rape a 15-year-old girl. He broke into a house. He got into the victim's bedroom. He jumped on her. He put his hand over her mouth. He threatened her with a knife. He, like, hit her on the side of the face. He bit her ear, but he ended up fleeing the attack because the victim's mom walked in and she screamed. And sadly, though, another person ended up being arrested for this, Anthony Hainmayer. He was 19 years old at the time. He was convicted of this assault and went to prison. He did 16 months in prison for this. He later got acquitted from it once Bernardo was like, oh yeah, that was me. So he's not obviously the person who Anthony Hainmayer was obviously not the person who did it, but he was the person who was initially charged with it. So that's really jacked up. And then December 16th, 1987, he raped a 15-year-old girl in Toronto. And I mean, he raped a 15-year-old girl. And then the next day, the Toronto police put out a warning to women all throughout Scarborough traveling alone at night to, you know, be careful. Like, hey, look, this is what's going on. December of 1987, he raped a 17-year-old girl with a knife. And that's kind of where he gets his name from. Like, at this point is where they come up with the name of the Scarborough Rapist, because he had been committing so many crimes. At this point, it's May to December, so it's a little over 6 months. And then he takes a really long break, and then he comes back April 18th, 1988. He attacks a 17-year-old girl. Then May 1988, he was nearly caught by a Metro Toronto investigator who's staking out a bus shelter. But, like, the investigator noticed that he was hiding under a tree and tried to pursue him on foot, but they never could catch him. Like, he escaped and got away. And then May 30th, 1988, he raped an 18-year-old woman in Missisquoi. I told y'all I'm not going to be able to say these right. Ontario, which is about 25 miles southwest of Scarborough. And then October 4th, 1988, he attempted to rape a woman, and he stabbed her twice in her thighs and twice, once in her thigh and one in her butt. I'm sorry. And then, but she was able to get away. She needed stitches, but she did survive the attack. I believe all of these women survived the attack. The initial ones, the ones that were on the buses. He raped an 18-year-old girl, December 16th, 1988, November 17th. They formed a task force to try to capture him. The police started to form a task force. At this point, it had been over a year, and they were just like, we cannot figure out who this is. December 27th of 1988, he attempted to rape a neighbor, but he got chased off, so he wasn't able to, you know, finish his assault. And then 6 months go by. June 20th, 1989, he attempts to rape a young woman, fights her, like, she fights him off. She alerted the neighbors because she was screaming, but he fled, but he had all these scratches all over his face. So then August 15th, 1989, he rapes a 22-year-old woman. November 21st, 1989, he raped a 15-year-old woman. He saw a 15-year-old girl, I'm sorry, he saw on a bus. And then December 22nd, 1989, he raped a 19-year-old woman. And then May 26th, he raped a 19-year-old woman. 1990, I'm sorry, May 26th, 1990, he raped a 19-year-old woman. But she had a very vivid recollection of her attacker, and she was able to give the police a description of him, and they created a computer composite of what he looked like, and they put that out. Now, I done ran through like almost 3 years worth of assaults that this man has been committing, because that's what he was on. All while he's doing all of this, he's with Carla. He met Carla October 1987. So from October of 1987 to July of 1990, the two of them are in this like committed relationship, whatever. She was like okay with like his sexual deviant fantasies and the things that he wanted to do. So it is believed that she knew what he was doing while they were dating, and she was just kind of like okay with it because it kind of took the heat off of her. Like, she didn't have to do a lot of that crap. But all of it really kind of blows up in the late 1990s. So November 20th, 1990, the police finally bring in Paul for the Scarborough rapist charges or cases that are out, because there were two people that he was friends and acquaintances with that were like, hey, I think it's him. It looks like the sketch looks like him. Pretty sure that it's him. So the police interviewed him, and when they talked to him, he looked at the sketch and he was like, yeah, that looks like me. It does. And he gave them a DNA sample, and they were like, okay. And like, he was released pending like the DNA coming back, but it was so new to Canada. They only had a couple of people that were really able to run the DNA system and testing and all of that stuff. So it took a really long time for them to be able to actually go and run the DNA. They had like 130 samples that still needed to be tested prior to getting to Paul Bernardo's. So his just kind of got thrown at the bottom of the pile, and he got released. Like, he was able to kind of go back into his world and go back into his life like nothing had just happened, even though there were people that were saying like, no, I'm pretty sure that was him, but they couldn't do anything because they didn't have the DNA results back yet. So like I said, all while he's doing all these other things as a Scarborough rapist, he's still with Carla. He's in a relationship with Carla, but he's also making it very clear that he like somebody that's real close to Carla. He has a little crushy crush on Carla's baby sister, Tammy, who is a teenager. So we're gonna take a pause there, and we're gonna talk about Carla for just a second. So Carla Homolka has a pretty like basic life. Like, I'm not even really gonna go into who Carla was, like, because she ain't much of shit, and that's really how I feel about her. Carla Homolka had a very normal life. She had her dad Carl and her mother Dorothy Homolka, and then her two sisters Tammy and Lori. They grew up, they had like all of them, they grew up a very like, you know, in the US we say, you know, married with 2.5 kids, the white picket fence. Like, it was very much giving that, like, they lived a very blue collar lifestyle, right? So there was nothing in the cards for Carla to end up dating somebody like Paul. Like, that kind of threw it off. But Paul was such a master manipulator and was able to camouflage and, you know, chameleon his way into things that the family loved him. Carla's little sister Tammy, she loved hanging out with Paul and hanging out with Carla because, I mean, what 15-year-old girl doesn't want to hang out with her big sister and her sister's boyfriend that she likes and thinks is cool or whatever? But all in reality, he has a little crush on her that Carla is aware of, like to the point where like they would Carla and Paul would role play and Carla would dress up as Tammy and pretend to be Tammy while they were having sex, like on multiple occasions, because he wanted Tammy's virginity because Carla could not give that to him because she had had sex before that. And he like had this thing about being able to take women's virginity, and the fact that he was with Carla, he felt that, you know, he should have been the one to have her virginity, and since he didn't take her virginity, he should be able to take Tammy's, or whatever little convoluted fucked up plan he had in his head. And at some point Carla says okay, and so the first thing she does is she has Tammy come like hang out with them. And she makes her a plate of spaghetti, and it's laced, but like, it's laced with sleeping pills, but it doesn't really work that well. Like, she woke up not too long after, like, she ingested it or whatever. And there's just like multiple occasions where like they were all alone together and they were like trying to get her, but it all kind of culminates to December 24th, 1990. It was really late at night. So I, even listening to all the different podcasts and documentaries, I hear Christmas and I hear Christmas Eve all the time. 24th or the 25th. Yeah, it's giving sometime at night. But they had already done their Christmas celebration. Like they had opened presents and done all these things or whatever. And I'm telling you all this because what happens next is really fucked up. So they had done all their Christmas things. They had done all of their family celebrations. Oh, yeah. This is my second trigger warning. This is the really big trigger warning. And after they had done their Christmas celebration, after, you know, they'd opened presents and eaten dinner and done the whole thing, Paul recorded it all. He video recorded it. You know, it's taped. It's nice and grand. Everybody goes to bed. But Paul and Carla ask Tammy if she wants to hang out with them in the basement. She's like, okay. And they're like, you know, you can have a little rum and eggnog, you know, a little spice eggnog and all that good stuff. And she's like, of course. Like, yes. Like, I'm about to go hang out with my sister, her boyfriend. I'm about to get me some liquor. I'm a teenager. Like, she hype. You know what I'm saying? I would have been hype. You know what I'm saying? So what she does not know is that her eggnog is dosed with sleeping pills. So she takes it, she drinks the eggnog, you know, and passes out. And then Paul begins to rape Tammy while Carla records it on the same video recorder they had used to record Christmas. They use that same camera to record Paul raping Tammy. Not only did they use the same camera, they used the same tape. So Christmas events end, and then it's like a psh, and then the next thing is the assault. Like, so they, again, so she's recording this. Sorry, Carla's recording this, and then Tammy starts to stir. She starts to wake up. Well, Carla was working at a vet office, which is how they were able to get these drugs, like the sleeping pills or whatever. But she was also able to get Halothane. I don't know how to say it. But it's a drug they use to sedate dogs for like surgeries and different things. She was able to get that drug and bring it home because she worked at like a veterinarian office. And so when her sister was waking up from the sleeping pills, they took a rag that was covered in halothane and covered her face. And that's like knocked her back out. Like the smell of the chemicals from the drugs knocked her back out. And they started taking turns holding the rag over her face and raping her. And they recorded it all. It's all on recording. And they continued to do this until Tammy started to aspirate and choke. And at that point, they stopped. They cleaned her up. They got her dressed. They put her in her room. They cleaned up the basement. They got dressed. And then they called 911. when police and ambulance show up, they're like, what is this mark on her face? She had this big chemical burn on her face. And they're like, what is this mark on her face? And they're like, Paul says, oh, I had to drag her to her room after she threw up from drinking. That's a rug burn. And the cops and everybody's like, okay. And then they do the autopsy and they don't look for drugs. They just took the story that Paul and Carla gave them, which was she got super drunk, she passed out and then started throwing up, and that's why she started choking. The police just took the story and ran with it. And then at the end of the day, the doctors who were also going over the case were like, yeah, that sounds about right. We're gonna label this an accidental death by alcohol, you know, choking from alcohol or whatever. Like, none of it made sense. Like, how did we get here, friends? Like, what? But that's what they did. Now, I also want to point out that they did all this 6 months before their wedding. Before Carla and Paul got married, 6 months before they get married, they rape, torture, and murder her sister in the basement. Christmas? This is what we do for the holidays. So because all of that happens, her family's like, yeah, we need time to like heal and get the fuck away. So her living sister went to their grandma's, and then her parents like went away to another territory in Canada so that they could like, you know, kind of get their heads together. And like Carla threw like this temper tantrum because her parents were so upset about the fact that their 15-year-old daughter has just died, and she's like, they don't care. Like, she's just throwing a temper tantrum, and it just shows how like irrational she is. Like, they're both irrational. They both just don't have any kind of common sense, any kind of logic, nothing. But Paul and Carla were able to just bounce back and keep doing what they were doing. They kept recording themselves having sex, and in those encounters, and again, this is all on video, this all gets played in the trial, which is how we know this. In those videos, Carla is dressed as Tammy after they've killed Tammy. Like, they're still pretending and role-playing as if Tammy was still alive. Like, they what the fuck? okay. So, that happened in December. So then June 7th, 1991... Carla invites a 15-year-old girl that she had befriended at the pet shop 2 years earlier. So we're going to call her Jane Doe, because she was called Jane Doe in the trials, and that's what she's been known by, and that's what we're going to call her, because again, we're respecting people's privacy here. So she's known as Jane Doe, and Jane Doe was invited for a girls' night out. And after an evening of shopping and dinner and, you know, the whole nine, Carla was like, hey, do you want to come hang out with us at the house? And she's like, sure. And so she goes to the house and she gets alcohol that's laced with halocene. And again, she loses consciousness. Now, at this point, it's just Carla. Paul is not with her. It's just Carla. Carla calls Paul and is like, hey, I have a surprise wedding gift for you. It's ready and waiting. Like, what the fuck, bro? You basically kidnapped a 15-year-old. Like, that's basically what you did. You basically kidnapped a 15-year-old to drug her and give her to your new husband. Like, what the fuck is wrong with you? So Paul videotaped Carla raping Jane Doe before he raped her himself. And then the next morning, Jane Doe woke up and she was just like kind of nauseated, but she thought that was just because, you know, she was drinking and that was the first time she had ever drank alcohol. And she didn't realize that she had been sexually assaulted that night. So then in August, she was invited, Jane Doe was invited back to their house to spend the night, and she was drugged again. Now this time, Carla ends up having to call 911 because the girl stops breathing, and they're like, oh shit, not again. And then she, like, they were able to resuscitate her and get her back up, and she was, you know, essentially okay. And so she calls him a few minutes later and she's like, oh yeah, everything's fine. Carla calls the police back. She's like, oh yeah, everything's fine. No need for anybody to come out. And so they didn't. Nobody ever went out. Nobody followed up with Jane Doe, and gratefully she survived. But she went through all of that just dealing with the two of them, because she was friends with somebody who worked at a pet shop. So then So again, this is June 7th, that one. So then the next assault is Leslie Mahaffey. This happened June 15th, 1991. This was like early in the morning. And Paul Bernardo was riding through Burlington, which is like kind of like a halfway point between Toronto and St. Catharines. He was stealing license plates. And he was like going around like different places, like stealing license plates. And this is where he sees Leslie Mahaffey. She was 14 years old. She had missed her curfew after going to a friend's wake, and she was locked out of the house. So Paul gets out of his car. He approaches her and he's like, yeah, I'm going to break into your neighbor's house. And she's like, okay, cool. Do you have a cigarette? And he's like, yeah, I do, at my car. Okay, quick sidebar. Friends. Do not go to people's cars, okay? I don't care what they have, a puppy, ice cream, a cigarette, liquor, it does not matter. Do not, I repeat, do not go to people's cars, please. Now, with that said, I am not blaming Leslie for this. She was a 14-year-old girl, and Paul is a piece of shit. I'm just gonna keep repeating that. But he leads her to the car, and when he gets her to the car, he blindfolds her and forces her in the car and then drives her to Port Dollhouse and tells Carla, hey, we got another victim. Like, he just informs it to her like it was just like a regular day. So Paul and Carla, once again, they're videotaping themselves torturing and sexually abusing Leslie while listening to Bob Marley and David Bowie. How dare you disrespect these two great legends of musicians? Why? Like, how dare you? The levels of disrespect. Okay. So, at one point in this, Paul turns to Leslie and tells her that she's doing a, quote, damn good job. And then he says that the next 2 hours are going to determine what I do to you, and right now you're scoring perfectly. Basically saying that, like, for the next 2 hours I'm going to continue to do this, and however I determine you do determines how much worse this does or does not get for you. Like, how the fuck does that work? Like, you're already assaulting somebody. How are you going to tell them it's up to them to make me stop? Like, no, just don't be a piece of shit human. And don't have a piece of shit wife who's going to sit there and allow you to do this and record. Like, just don't be pieces of oh my. Sorry. But the reason I say that is because this was the way that people were trying to prove that, like, everything was on Paul. Like, Paul was, like, the mastermind behind this. When reality, he was part of the plan, but he didn't do all the shit. And we'll get there. So obviously Leslie is like crying and begging for Paul to stop, but like he's not. Leslie at some point tells Paul, my blindfold is slipping. Like, she's trying to like inform him, like, hey, I might be able to see you, which signaled like she could possibly still be able to identify them. Like, we don't know if she was like, hey, my blindfold's slipping, and like it had slipped and she saw, or what. Like, nobody knows. So the following day, this is according to Paul, he says Carla fed her a lethal dose of Halocene, and Carla says that the following day Paul just strangled her. But then they both said that they put Leslie's body in a basement, and that same day they had Carla's family come over for dinner at the house. Like, the body was in the basement, and then Carla's family was up on a regular floor in the family room having dinner. It was her mama, her daddy, her sister, her husband, and herself. What the fuck is wrong with y'all? Like, Paul and Carla, what is y'all problem? After the family leaves, they're like, okay, we got to figure out how to get rid of the body. So Paul and Carla decide that the best way to do this would be to dismember Leslie and then encase all of her remains in separate pieces of cement and then like toss them. So he went out and bought a bunch of cement at a hardware store the next day, and he kept the receipts. Stupid ass, part of the reason why his ass got caught. And then Paul used a circular saw to dismember Leslie, and then they made a bunch of trips to dump the cement blocks in Lake Gibson, which is about 11 miles south of where they lived. At least one of the blocks weighed about 200 pounds. And basically it was like, it was making it past their ability for it to sink. Like, it was too heavy for it to sink at this point. Like, it was just a bad situation. So it just was near the shore. Like, it just laid near the shore of Lake Gibson, and it was found by Michael Doucette and his son Michael Jr. while they were fishing on June 29th, 1991. So that's what happens to Leslie. The next victim is Kristen French. She was born, her assault happened April 16th, 1992. Again, this is Paul and Carla. They were driving through St. Catharines, and they were essentially just kind of searching for a victim. Like, they were just kind of looking around, seeing who was available, what they were going to do. And although there were, like, students that were going home from school, the streets were pretty empty. Like, they really couldn't find anyone. But as they were passing Holy Cross Secondary School, which is a Catholic school in the, like, north end of the city, they see Kristen French, she was 15 at the time, walking to her home. They pulled into the parking lot of a nearby Lutheran church. Carla gets out of the car with a map in her hand, and she's like, hey, I need help, like, can you tell me how to get there? And when Kristen looked down to look at the map, Paul grabbed her from behind, brandishing a knife, and then forced her into the front seat of the car. And then Carla got in the back seat and, like, grabbed Kristen's hair, like, forcing her to sit back so she couldn't get out of the car. Now, Kristen was one of those girls that she walked the same way to and from school every single day. She did not deviate. When she left the house, she went straight to school. When she left school, she went straight to the house. One reason and one reason why she always went home after school is because she had a puppy, and she was making sure she took her baby out for a walk. And baby, do I understand that, because I have puppies, and that's the same thing that I do. I get out of work, first thing I do is go home and make sure my dogs are okay. And it takes her about 15 minutes to walk home, which her parents knew. But the fact that she did not come home in 15 minutes, you know, they probably gave her about a 5 minute little bit of a leeway, but when they saw she wasn't coming home, they immediately knew something was wrong. She was met with foul play. Something bad had just happened, because this is not like her. So within 24 hours, the NRP, or the Niagara Regional Police Service, assembled a team and started searching for Kristen. They found several witnesses who had seen her be abducted from different locations. So there are people that were, like, in apartments and in buildings and in offices and the churches and stuff. Like, they saw it happen, but they really weren't sure of what was happening. But because they saw this from different directions, they were able to give a very clear picture of what happened. They found Kristen's shoe from, like, they found it in the parking lot. And this kind of, like, really showed how serious, like, they were like, okay, no, this is serious. Like, her shoe got left behind. Like, something really happened. So this all happens over the Easter weekend. So she gets kidnapped on, like, a Friday, or abducted on a Friday. And they videotaped themselves torturing, assaulting, sodomizing, raping, like, just attacking this poor girl and forcing her to drink large amounts of alcohol, like, that whole weekend. And at trial, when they were talking about specifically Kristen, they were like, you know, Paul always intended to kill her because she was never identified, and she was never blindfolded. She was never blindfolded, and she could easily identify her captor. So the idea was, like, they never had any intentions of, like, letting her go. So that was, you know, the screwed up part of that. So Friday, Saturday, they assaulted her, and then the following day, Paul and Carla murdered her before going to Carla's parents' house for Easter dinner. Now, Carla is terrible because she testified at Paul's sentencing, at trial and at sentencing, saying that he strangled Kristen for 7 minutes while she watched. But Paul said that Carla beat Kristen with a rubber mallet because she tried to escape, and then, like, strangled Kristen with a noose around her neck, which was secured to a hope chest. And then apparently Carla went to go fix her hair afterwards. Like, that's how Paul said it. So Paul is saying that, like, no, Carla beat her with a mallet and then strangled her with a noose and then went to go fix her hair while old girl died. Whereas Carla's like, no, he just strangled her. Like, what? So y'all can agree that she was strangled, but how we got here, nobody can agree on. And the thing about this, right, they record everything except for how the women die. They recorded everything else except for how the women die. That's the one thing that's not on camera, and that's why there's two sides of, like, well, he said this and she said that, and he said this and she said that, because there is no answer to, like, what actually happened. So on April 30th, 1992, Kristen's nude body was found in a ditch in Burlington, about 45 minutes away from St. Catharines, and a very short distance from the cemetery where Leslie Mahaffey was buried. She had been washed, her hair was cut off, and although initially it was thought that they cut off Kristen's hair as a trophy to, like, keep it or whatever, Carla later says that it was cut off so that people wouldn't be able to identify Kristen. So yeah, that is all of what happened. This is what they did prior to, you know, I mean, this is everything that they did together. This is everything he did prior to them meeting. So I'm gonna take a break real quick, because this is a lot. So yeah, I'll be right back. Okay, y'all, so we are back. So let's get into the arrest. We spent a lot of time on what happened, so we're gonna, like, kind of move on. The arrest is a mess, just like everything else. So basically they get caught because Paul beats up Carla. That's how that goes. But we're gonna start from the top and tell y'all exactly how this went down. So Paul and Carla have been questioned by the police several times in connection with the Scarborough rapist, Tammy's death, Paul stalking other women prior to Kristen's death, and officers have filed reports on this, but specifically May 2nd, 1992, there was a sergeant who had an interview with Paul, and he decided that he was an unlikely suspect. He was like, yeah, no, I really don't think that it's this dude. Like, I know a lot of y'all are like, but he's like, I really don't think it's him, even though Paul was like, yeah, I've been questioned before, and yeah, I look like the sketch, you know, I gave my DNA. Like, because he had done all of these things, because he was so cool and suave about it all, they were like, there's no way that it could be him. Well, after they had done this interview with Paul, about 3 days later, they made a task force called the Green Ribbon Task Force to investigate the murders of Leslie and Kristen, because they had started to realize something about these two specific crimes seemed too coincidental, too similar. Around that time, also, Paul and Carla had applied to have their names legally changed to Teal, which Paul got from some serial killer in the 1988 film Criminal Law. If y'all know me, I don't do serial killer films. I don't like scary movies. I will watch a true crime documentary in a heartbeat, but do not put a scary movie in front of me. It is not for me. Okay, thank you. But all that to say, he wanted to change his last name to Teal because of this serial killer in this film. Now, granted, that serial killer isn't, like, they don't spell their name the same. Like, it was weird. He was spelling it T-E-A-L-E, but the person in the movie spelled it T-H-I-E-L. Yeah, I don't know what was going on there. But by the end of May, John Motiel, which was a friend, like, associate, a friend of Paul's, also went to the police and was like, I think Paul could be the person that y'all are looking for. Like, it looks like him. In December of 1992, the Center of Forensic Science finally started testing the DNA samples that Paul had given them 2 years earlier. And then on December 27th, he severely beat Carla on the limbs, head, and face with a flashlight, and then said she was in a car accident. She was severely bruised, obviously, but she returned to work on January 4th, 1993. Obviously, her coworkers looking at her a little skeptical, like, girl, what's going on? She was like, oh, nothing happened, but they called her parents. And her parents did come. They rescued her. They took her away. But the next day, she goes back to the house because she's, like, frantically searching for something. Her parents take her to St. Catherine's General Hospital, where she gives a statement to the NRP that she's a battered spouse, and she files charges against Paul. He was arrested, and then later he was released on his own recognizance, and then a friend of Paul's found a suicide note that Paul had written and intervened and stopped him. And then Carla was taken to Brampton to go stay with relatives. So that is kind of how all of this comes to an end. Paul, 26 months after Paul had given them the DNA sample, the police were able to say, yes, that's him. And at that point, he was put under 24-hour surveillance. The Metro Toronto Sexual Assault Squad investigators interviewed Carla February 9th of 1993. Despite hearing their suspicions about Paul, Carla mainly focused on the abuse that she faced from him. Later, after that interview, she goes home and tells her aunt uncles that Paul is the Scarborough rapist. Like, she knew that was him, and that she and Paul were involved in the rape and murder of Leslie and Kristen. Like, she tells it all to her uncle, aunt and uncle, and then she also tells them that the rapes and everything are recorded on videotape. So at this point, the NRP reopens its investigation of Tammy Homolka's death. And then 2 days later, Carla has to meet with a Niagara Falls lawyer, George Walker, who's looking for legal immunity because she is, quote, a battered spouse. And so he's going to prosecution like, hey, look, she needs to be protected. So she's placed under 24-hour surveillance as well. Like, she's being watched, but like, her lawyer's going out saying that she needs to be protected. And then on February 17th, the Metro Sexual Assault Squad and Green Ribbon Task Force arrest Paul on several charges. They get a search warrant because he is linked to murders, but the link is very weak, so the warrant is very limited. Basically, they couldn't, like how some of the warrants, like, you can basically destroy the house, knock down the walls, take up the carpets, the whole nine. They could not do that. The damage had to be kept at a minimum. They couldn't tear down walls. They were only looking for the videotapes. They couldn't tear down the walls to look for the videotapes. So, like, if he hid them behind a wall or something, they couldn't look behind that wall to find it. They only could look for the videotapes. And the videotapes had to be viewed at the house to be proven, like, that was the tape. So the search of the house, including, like, updated warrants, because, like, as they were finding tapes and finding stuff, the warrants were getting updated. It lasts 71 days. And the only tape found by police was a very brief segment of Carla performing oral sex on Jane Doe. Like, that was the tape they found. That was how they kept, you know, being able to go back and search, because it was like, we have this. Like, we know something's here. They couldn't find anything. At this point, they're like, yo, what are we supposed to do? Like, we know something happened here. So on May 5th, Carla's lawyer goes back. He talks to the government, and they're like, hey, look, we'll give you a plea bargain of 12 years. She has 1 week to accept the plea. If she declines it, the government's going to charge her with 2 counts of first degree murder and 1 count of second degree murder and a bunch of other crimes. So obviously, her lawyer accepts the offer. Carla later agrees on it. And on May 14th, Carla's plea bargain was finalized. She started giving statements to police. She told the police that Paul boasted and that he had raped as many as 30 women, twice as many as police initially suspected. And she started calling him a happy rapist. Now, I want y'all to realize all this is behind what Carla is saying. Like, Carla is an angel, and like, nothing, like, she just been through so much. Like, she didn't have any parts of this. But here's the other part of this. They couldn't find all the damn tapes. They found one tape that had a clip of something that happened. And if I'm not mistaken, they found other tapes, but nothing that was, like, damning. If that makes any sense. Like, there wasn't anything, like, any other, like, sexual clips. Like, they only found the oral sex clip from that Carla was the one doing the oral sex. But, like, she said she was forced and whatever. So there was that. So once Paul is arrested, Carla takes a plea bargain. So she's only doing 12 years. Like, she don't have to go to trial and do all that stuff. She took a deal. She's pleading guilty. Paul is going to trial. And because he's going to trial, they go to the judge and they're like, hey, look, we need a publication. Like, we need a publication ban because this is just too big of a case, and he still deserves to have a fair trial. But, you know, one of the few times I will ever say USA for the fucking win, bro, because that fucking publication ban was only in Canada, and us on the other side of that motherfucking border, on the other side of that water, baby, we was getting all the tea. Okay? We was close enough to the border that we were getting all the information. Journalists were constantly putting out information about what was going on, what was in the case, what did Carla say. Once they were in the trial, everything came out. The videotapes finally fucking surfaced and all kinds of shit. So Carla's battered wife, battered spouse syndrome bullshit went right the fuck out the window. At least in the US eyes. And then eventually in the Canadian eyes. But in the US eyes, we immediately were like, oh, that's some bullshit. Because there was no publication ban on our side. We knew what the fuck was going on. So, you know, the trial ended up being kind of quick and dirty. Paul was tried for the murders of Kristen French, Leslie Mahaffey in 1995. And it included like very detailed testimony from Carla and the videotapes. Like, and then of course Paul like comes out and he's like, you know, we killed him on accident. And then he was like, no, my wife is the one who did this. Like, my wife is a fucking psychopath. And they were like, bro, that's kind of the pot calling the kettle black, but all right. And he was like, I did not kill anybody. I raped them. I said that. You see it on camera. I can't deny that. She's the murderer. She kills people, not me. But September 1st, 1995, Paul was convicted on a bunch of offenses, including 2 first degree murder charges, 2 aggravated sexual assault, and sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. And he was designated a dangerous offender, making him unlikely to ever be released. So Paul is literally going to be in jail for the rest of his glory days while Carla is walking the streets free as a bird. Yeah, she's out there, y'all. She's free as a bird. So we're going to talk about this plea bargain. So, at the time, they were really, really, really big on making this case against Paul because he was also the Scarborough rapist. Like, they wanted to make sure everything stuck and his ass was going down. And his ass did go down. But the problem is they took a chance. And the chance they took was a bad chance. Bro, you took a shot in the dark. Like, that was not it. They made a bad choice. They gave her the choice to take a plea and to testify against Paul. But at the time, nobody had seen the tapes. Nobody knew how involved she actually was. Paul's lawyers hid the tapes for 17 months so nobody could see them. And this is how Carla gets a 12-year deal instead of doing life in prison and be put on this damn dangerous offender list and making it so her ass can never get out. No, she's just walking, you know, around like didn't shit just happen. So she did 12 years. And like the beginning part of her sentence, like she ends up in like this like cushy, what was it, medium security prison where she was like happy living her best life. And like Canadians complain because like, fuck yeah, I would complain too. Bitch, what the fuck? You killed your sister. Like, let's be real about this, bro. You killed your sister and you're sitting here just living up your best life in a medium security prison where you basically can do whatever the fuck you want. And then because of the uproar, she eventually got moved to a maximum security prison where she, you know, suffered for whatever time that she was in prison. But she was eventually released July 4th, 2005. And when she was released, she had a lot of rules. A lot of rules. And I think she well deserved most of them. So she had to tell the police her home address, work address, and whom she lived with. That was the first one. The second one was she was required to notify police as soon as any of the above things changed. 3, she was required to notify police of any changes to her name. 4, if she planned to be away from her home for more than 48 hours, she had to give a 72-hour notice. 5, she could not contact Paul Bernardo, the family of Leslie Mahaffey, or Kristen French, or that of the woman known as Jane Doe, or any other violent criminals. 6, she was forbidden to be with people under the age of 16. 7, she was forbidden from consuming drugs other than prescription medicine. 8, she was required to continue therapy and counseling. And 9, she was required to provide police with a DNA sample. Now, rule number 5, the very end, or any other violent criminals. little sidebar real quick. This bitch was in a whole fucking relationship while she was in jail. She was put in a jail that was connected to a men's prison, and she found a way to meet a man, get in a relationship, and this man was just fucking as psycho as Paul. He had like raped and strangled his girlfriend, and that's why he was in prison. And she gonna fall in love with this fool, and they was fucking. That's why she could never get, like, she had went up for parole before. She had like a fourth of her sentence left, so basically like probably like three, four years left, and she had went up for parole, and they were like, no, you're gonna reoffend, like, you're a dangerous person, we don't want you out of here. But she only had a 12-year sentence, so they didn't have an option at the end of her sentence. Like, she has to get out. Like, that's not the there's no option here. After 12 years, she's done. But they were like, she's crazy, like, she's gonna do it again. But in 2006, all these rules went away because her and her lawyers, they end up going back, you know, and they're just like, yeah, these aren't fair. Like, in reality, it was a little overzealous, it wasn't fair. She did try to change her name. That shit did not work. At first they were like, it's a no for us. But she does end up getting remarried. She marries the brother of her lawyer. She marries her lawyer's brother. And she legally changes her name to Leanne Bordalis. She has 3 children. And I'm going to give you a quick rundown. You can go in. There's like a really in-depth article that I'm going to link at the bottom, that link in my show notes, that tell you exactly like what happened with her post prison. I'm not gonna go super in depth with that, but she gets married, she ends up having 3 kids, and she puts her kids in a public school. And at this point, again, she had changed her name, and, you know, figured, you know, don't nobody know me, might know my business. She wasn't close to where she was, she wasn't like in the Scarborough area anymore, she had moved away. And basically she was like volunteering at her child's school, and somebody found out and like figured out she is Leslie is Carla. Carla is Leslie. They told the school, and the school said everything's okay. And they was like, hell nah, bro, because Carla is Leslie and Leslie is Carla, and Carla is crazy. She need not be here. And they literally put up this big ass stink until the point where the school was like, okay, yeah, no, you can no longer volunteer here. And Carla was told she can't volunteer at her child's school anymore. And then ultimately, her husband ends up leaving her. As of 2020, her husband left her and he took the kids. So she is completely alone. She is completely alone. She has nobody. She has no family. She has no friends. Nothing. Because of what she did. And just the fact that she even decided to have kids. Like, bitch, you're terrible. Because now your kids have to live with the fact that their shit ass mama is you. And then another sidebar. Hold on. Remember I told you Paul and Carla wanted to change their name to Teal? Well, Carla was going to change her name to Leanne Teal. What did she change her name to when she got married? Leanne Bordalis. Still obsessed with Paul much, bitch? Yeah. So that's the Ken and Barbie killers, y'all. I'm sorry, that was a lot. There was a lot going on there. This whole episode was a lot, but we have made it through, y'all. We have made it to the end. Another week, y'all. I did it. 2 weeks in a row, I'm back, y'all. I'm back in my flow. I can honestly say last week it was kind of weird being back behind the mic, but I'm really happy to be back. I'm happy everything is back to normal. I feel super good. So yeah, I appreciate everybody for sticking around with me, continuing to support me. I really love y'all. Like I said, I'm gonna keep being consistent, I'm gonna keep being better. If I fall off, I'm sorry, but just know that there are always going to be new episodes coming. I have some bangers coming. I'm going to be done with school soon, so summertime, here we come. I have more free time, so we're back. So again, thank you so much for tuning in. Thank you so much for joining me. Follow me on Instagram at True Crime Boulevard. That's TrueCrimeBLVD. Or you can email me at truecrimeboulevard@gmail.com. truecrimeboulevard is spelled the exact same way, @gmail.com. if you have any cases you like me to look into, you want to give me any feedback, all that good stuff. If you want to follow me personally, you can follow me at _BriaDaniels, briadaniels. It's always in the show notes, but sometimes I do get messages, So you guys can go follow me over there if you kind of want to know more about like what's going on with me, why did I MIA for a while. Some of that stuff is over there. So yeah, thank you again for joining me, and until next time, I'm your host Bree, and I will see you back on the Boulevard. Peace.